thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be back at the Perimeter Institute, even though it's only at a virtual way. Hopefully next time I'll be there enjoying these famous cappuccino machines. So today I'm going to talk about cosmic strings and the nanograph data. This is work we've been doing over the years in collaboration with people at Tufts University, in particular with Ken Olum, Ben Schleyer, Javier Siemens, and Jamie Wachter. So we work on cosmic strings, and my goal today is to convince you that cosmic strings, even though they are an exotic source of gravitational waves, they are pretty natural in some sense, and they accommodate the data from nanograph in a very natural way. So that's the final goal. Let's see if I succeed to do that. So the outline of the talk is the following. I'll introduce cosmic strings and what they are and the dynamics that they have. This is important for you to understand why they are a natural source of gravitational waves. Then I'll move on to cosmological networks, how they form, and what kind of simulations we can do to extract the information that we need to obtain the or to compute the stochastic background of gravitational waves. Once we do that, then we compare with the data, in particular with the nanograph 12.5-year data. And at the end, I'll conclude with some open issues and some conclusions. So the first thing is to explain what a cosmic string is. Of course, what I'll do is to describe what my version of a cosmic string is. So as you may know, there are two different ways of interpret cosmic strings. You can imagine that cosmic strings are produced as topological defects in field theory. In this particular type of models, these objects are very much similar to superconductor vortices, right? We are familiar with vortices, superconductors, which are the places where the magnetic field enters the superconductor. Now, what we want to do is the relativistic version of that, which is instead of the usual theory of superconductivity would be the Abelian-Higgs model, for example. And in that case, there are solutions that are, actually look exactly the same as the Bricusov vortices, except that when you look at the dynamics, they are relativistic. So the static solutions are the same, but the dynamics are different. And as I explained in a second, this type of objects exist in many models that are extensions of the standard model. Then there are other kind of strings that you can imagine in models in cosmological models in the string theory, where cosmic superstrings, the actual strings of the string theory, can be stretched by the expansion of the universe to become cosmological in size. And then they would behave, they become semi-classical, and they would behave like classical objects. And in some sense, they would be similar to the classical defects of the previous models. However, there are some differences that I'll point it out in a few transparencies. But it's also very interesting to think about these type of models where you can get some signature from string theory, from cosmology. So let me first start with the field theory models. So the simplest theory that you can imagine that has this type of vortices is this one that I read right here. Can you see my cursor, by the way? Yes, okay, good. So this is a four-dimensional theory where I have a complex scalar field. And the important thing with this scalar field is that it has a potential. It's famous, Mexican half potential, that is parameterized with only one parameter, the energy parameter, which is this eta, that basically parameterizes the height of this potential. Now, the fact that this theory has a U1 symmetry means that the vacuum manifold here is just a circle, which means that any position, any phase of this scalar field would be the same, would be an analog vacuum like any other one. So if we give a color to each of these faces, we can say that the blue vacuum, the red vacuum, or the green vacuum are all equivalent. However, there are important moments where this the fact that there is a vacuum manifold, which is a circle, becomes important. And this was pointed out first by Tom Keeble. So Keeble realized that in the early universe, different regions of space-time could pick a different face. So we can have a situation like this, where we have regions which are separated by large distances larger than the horizon. And because they are not causally connected, they could pick any of the faces. In particular, they could be of any color. So this is all fine, because as I said, they are causally disconnected, but as the universe expands, these causally disconnected regions come into causal contact. So when that happens, they have to do something about the center. They have to think about what to do about the face. And of course, they quarrel about what is the right face. They don't agree. And what they do is they go to the top of the potential, which means that it's going to be some energy stored at the center of this configuration. In fact, what happens is that there is a vortex forming there, because this the vortex would be the lowest energy configuration once you impose the infinite, the boundary conditions at infinity. Okay, so the vortex is going to form in the center just because you put the boundary conditions at infinity with a winding face. Okay, now this is in two dimensions. The argument can be extended to three dimensions, and the center would be a region where the scalar field would be at the top of the potential, and therefore there would be some energy, high energy, that has to do with the amount of energy of the scale of eta that I mentioned earlier. So before the symmetry breaking happens, right? So these strings form and they store at the core a very high energy, energy that has to do with the previous stage before the phase transition. Now, what are the characteristics of these strings? So as I mentioned, these are topologically stable objects because they are the lowest energy configuration with the boundary conditions. So it's not that you can have this object and just dissolves its energy. In order to, it's the same as a vortex, right? We have a vortex, and the only way you can kill this vortex is by placing an anti-vortex and annihilate it with a vortex. So for the same reason, the only way that you can unwind this string and make the energy decay is by colliding it with some other part of the string, or making a loop collapse, as we will explain later. The other important thing is that these objects have the energy density equal to their tension. So that means that they have a huge tension. This is unlike normal non-relativistic strings, like the ones that we are used to, that we use for our shoelaces. Our shoelaces have an energy which is much higher than the tension, which is good. Otherwise, it would be very hard to tie your shoelaces. But these objects have the same. This means that if you think about it, traveling waves on these objects would have a speed, which is the speed of light. That in turn means that the typical velocities of this object is going to be relativistic. Okay. Now, the final ingredient I want to point out here is that I'm not going to couple this theory to any other massless field that is not, so the only field that couples this massless is the graviton. Okay. Now, of course, in the model I just mentioned, of course, there is another coupling, which is to the Goldstone mode. But as I said, in the Abelian-Higgs model, there all the modes in the vacuum are massive, and therefore the strings do not couple to anything that is massless except gravity. Now, this is the simplest version of the strings. You can write a model that violates one or many or all of these requirements. And this would be also interesting to study. However, it complicates things, and they are not so, they haven't been studied as much as the simplest one. That is the one I'm going to concentrate on today. Okay. Okay. So as I mentioned, there is only one parameter, one scale, which is the eta parameter. So let me just give you a few numbers just to keep everybody on the same page. So we are typically thinking that this U1 theory that creates these streams is coming from a granified theory scale. So let's think about, for example, an eta scale of 10 to the 16 GeV. Okay, so this is an extension on the standard model where the streams, the phase transition occurs at this scale. And if you put numbers into the characteristics of this string, you can work out the thickness of the string, which is related to the inverse of the energy scale. And then you see that for this energy, the thickness of the string is 10 to minus 30 centimeters. So it's really microphysics scale, right? On the other hand, these objects can be infinite or very large, or they can be loops which are cosmological in size. The other important thing is that if you compute the amount of mass per unit length, this is huge also. It's huge because you're creating this object out of this scale, which is also extremely large for everyday standards. So the typical for this scale, the energy per unit length is 10 to the 22 grams per centimeter. So if you imagine a string stretching for the diameter of the Earth, you get a huge amount of mass. Okay, huge, like, you know, like a solar mass type of mass. And the tension, of course, is gigantic, of course, for any everyday life tension. So this, thinking about these numbers, you should already see that these objects are interesting from the point of view of cosmology, because they are huge masses. They move relativistically, as I just mentioned. So clearly, this seemed to be like the perfect object to create gravity waves. And in fact, this is why we are going to describe the rest of the talk. Now, for the rest of the talk, I want you to remember that there's only one parameter, one scale, which is eta. But typically, because we're interested in gravity and the interactions of these things with gravity, the way we describe it is by writing this dimensionless format, which is g mu, which is basically the ratio of eta and Planck mass, the square. So for 10 to the 16 GeV, this is of the order of 10 to minus 6. So the important thing for you to remember is that g mu, whatever you see g mu, this is a very small number. In fact, that towards the end of the talk, when I start talking about constraints, you will see that actually the constraints are even reducing this number quite a bit, okay? But every time you see something as g mu, you should remember that it's very small. All right, so I already mentioned that how these objects are created, and this was discussed by Tom Keevil in 1976. Now, it is important to realize that this phase transition that produced these strings have to be happening after inflation, okay? Because if you produce them earlier or during inflation, the expansion of the universe is so vast that it's going to dilute this string so much that you will not see one in the whole visible universe. But in fact, this is not so contrived, because many models of inflation end with a phase transition. So you can imagine that the phase transition that ends inflation is the one that is producing the strings. In fact, this is what is suggested in many models of brain inflation, where brains inflation is basically given or produced by the motion of two brains that they approach one another. And when inflation ends is when the two brains collide, and therefore they produce a network of strings in that phase transition. So is you know, there are models where this is naturally occurring. Oops. Okay. All right, so we know that they exist in models of field theory. We know that they are creating cosmology. Okay, how do we understand the signatures? Well, for that, we need to know their dynamics. So taking into account this properties that I mentioned before, that the fact that the string is could be cosmological in size, but the thickness is particle physics is small, 10 to minus 30 centimeters. We can imagine that using the number got approximation for the dynamics is the right approach. The number got approximation is just thinking that the only thing that you care about is the position of the string, that there is no other degree of freedom except the position of the string. Then if you think about what kind of action I can write, well, you can write the generalization of the relativistic point-like particle. The relativistic point-like particle, the action is just the world line. So here what you have to do is just to write the action, which is the area of the world sheet, which is the area that the stream moving in space-time is going to create, right? So this is described here. This is just the expression of this area, where gamma is the induced metric on the wall sheet, and mu is the only parameter, the tension of the string, okay? Now from here, we want to find the position of the string as a function of sigma and tau, which are the two parameters on the wall sheet. You have a space-like parameter, sigma, that parameterizes the string at each moment in time, right? You have a string like this, and you want to parameterize it with a parameter. And then tau, which parameterizes the evolution in time. So this action has a lot of gauge freedom. So one thing that you should do is to choose the gauge in a smart way. And these two conditions are particularly nice. The second one, for example, tells you that the velocity of the string, which is x dot, is always going to be perpendicular to the tangent vector, which makes sense because if you have a straight string, there's nothing that tells you where you are in the string. So it doesn't mean anything to say that you're moving along the string, right? It only means something to move perpendicular to the string. And the other constraint tells you that the parameter sigma basically parameterizes the energy per unit length of the string. Now, this is a very interesting gauge because if you look at the equations of motion for this action in this gauge, they are very, very simple. In fact, they're just a wave equation in two dimensions. I mean, in sigma and tau dimensions, where this is a vector position. So we can solve any string configuration by just saying that is the sum of two functions, A and B, that they are moving in one direction or the other, right? Like any solution of the wave equation are just traveling waves in one direction and the other. The same thing here. Now, we just have to remember that we have to satisfy the constraints. So once you have your answers for the general solution, you have to plug it into the constraints. And what you see is that the only constraint is that these vectors A prime and B prime have to be normalized to one, which means that these two functions are functions on a unit sphere, okay? So if you want to write, after the talk, you go home and want to create a solution for a number of auto action, the only thing that you have to do is to write a function on a sphere, write another function of the sphere, and then parameterize it correctly, and then just plug it in here, and that's it. You get yourself a solution for this, and you can see it evolving very easy. So it's interesting. By the way, this is only in flat space. But this is interesting because since it's integral, we can, given the position and the velocity of the string at one moment, you know exactly the whole history of this thing, right? Now, there is another detail which is important. It's what happens when the strings intercommute, because in the network, like such the one I have behind me, things are going to happen where the strings are going to cut each other or intersect each other. So people simulated this in field theory, and what came out of this numerical experiments is that the strings exchange partners. So what happens is that there's intercommutation happening, and the loop can be created by a self-intersection of a string. Now, this is very important in what I'm going to say in a minute, because without this, the whole picture of the network of strings will not work. But let me also point out that it's important because at each point that one of these things happen, the strings that are left behind have a very sharp change in the tangent vector, okay? These things are called kinks, and these kinks on the string move at the speed of light. So they are specific points on the string where, the tangent vector changes discontinuously. And this is going to be also important later on for the computation of the gravitational waves. So that's why I'm mentioning it now. And these things could build up in the course of the evolution, because strings are going to self-intersect many, many times, not only one or twice, but many, many times. Okay, what about the dynamics of loops? Well, it's the same equation, the same solution. The only thing that you have to do for A and B is you have to make functions which are periodic. This is because you want the loop to close, right, at the end. But this already tells you that the solutions are going to be periodic, which is not surprising. If you imagine a circular loop of a rubber band with a lot of tension, you know what it's doing, right? It's going to stretch and compress and stretch, right? So you can write that solution in 1 minute and convince yourself that that solution that you already know is within one of those solutions. Now, because of the tension, as I said before, the strings move typically relativistically. And in fact, there are points along the evolution of the string where the stream can move at the speed of light and momentarily. You can see this easily by computing the velocity, x dot, the modulus of x dot is just 1/2 because of this solution is just 1/2 b prime minus a prime. But these two functions are both of them on the sphere. So if you imagine that this is a situation where b prime is equal to minus a prime, these two are the same, and therefore the modulus would be 1. So it moves at the speed of light. So when this happens, this happens when this function and this function coincide. So because both of this function live on a sphere, you can imagine the situation where these two functions intersect. If they intersect on the sphere, that means that particular point, the string is going to be moving at speed of light. Okay, this was, by the way, pointed out by Neil Turok many years ago. So I thought that I should mention this, the perimeter. So by doing this exercise that I mentioned before, you can do movies and you can see places where the string oscillates. This is an actual solution of the Nambu-Goto equation of motion. And there are points where the string moves at the speed of light. You can zoom in there and color the string by the velocity. So red is the speed of light. And if you look at this, there's going to be some point where it moves at the speed of light. It's only momentarily, but it concentrates a lot of energy in that point and moves at the speed of light in some direction. So this is also going to be important for later on for gravitational waves, as you can imagine, because it has a lot of energy. It's going to concentrate at some point and it's going to be beaming gravitational waves in one direction. Okay. All right. So of course, for us, for what I'm going to say later, loops are very important because they are the source of the gravitational waves. However, loops are more important for another reason. That is that the whole model has to be viable from the point of view of cosmology. But if you don't have a mechanism to lose energy, the network would dominate the energy density in the universe, which we know is wrong, okay? So in order to avoid this type of monopole problem, you have to have some mechanism by which the network loses energy. And in these models, this is thanks to the production of loops. Because the longer strings would produce loops, the loops have their tension, so they oscillate. As they oscillate, they emit gravitational radiation, and as they evaporate all this energy into gravitational waves, at the end they disappear. But the network as a whole transforms energy from the length of a string into gravitational waves, and therefore it makes it a viable model of cosmology. Okay, but as I said, this is something that's important regardless if you can observe the gravitational waves or not. But in fact, this is actually what we want to calculate, right? So you can do a very simple back of the envelope calculation and say, well, imagine I have a loop. What kind of evolution I would have if it's evaporating by gravitational waves? So you can compute the power very roughly, the power emitted by the loop, by the quadruple formula. And then if you just work out the details, imagine that you're only emitting at the simplest, lowest mode. And then you realize that this power is just given by g mu squared times some factor that has to do with the shape of the loop. And people have calculated this this number in simple loops, and it's of the order of 50 or 100. This is actually calculated a long time ago. So what happens is that the loop gets created from the network, starts oscillating, emitting energy in gravitational radiation with this power law. And therefore its length is going to be decreasing, okay? So the length of the loop is the initial length when it's created minus gamma g mu times the difference in time. Now remember that g mu, I told you, is very small and gamma is only of the order of 100. So this means that the length of the loop is going to be decreasing, but very slowly with time. Now, if I tell you that because the object is relativistic, the period of the loop is basically the length, basically the length of the object. This is also telling you that a typical loop that gets created is going to be oscillating for you know, billions of times. Okay, throughout the history of the universe. So it's not that it's created and disappears, created and oscillates many, many times. The smaller g mu it is, the longer it's going to last because the power is the media is less. Okay, and we will take the approach to do the calculations that this law is basically respected, that the length of the loop is just decreasing by this power. Okay, so if you want to find signatures of cosmic strings in gravitational waves, there are two main strategies, which is simple to understand after what I said. One is to compute the stochastic gravitational background of all the loops throughout the history of the universe, and what we can see at some particular frequency today, which is the model or the calculation I'm going to describe in more detail. The other possibility is try to look for bursts. And this burst is due to these cusps that I mentioned earlier, which happen in individual loops. And so these cusps are going to generate a lot of gravitational radiation in some direction. So if we happen to be, if the Earth happens to be in that direction, we will get a huge burst of energy. Okay, so that's another strategy to look for these signals. Well, we can comment on both of them, but in order to talk about nanograph, the one that is relevant is the first one. Of course, you can also think that the first one, the stochastic background, includes part of the individual bursts in the sense that if you cannot identify them as separate, then part of the stochastic background is composed of the collection of many cusps. Okay, so this, as you can see by the references here, it has been computed many times. And the ingredients are actually to compute this are very similar to any other source of a stochastic background, including astrophysical background. So normally people denote the stochastic background by the fraction of the energy density in gravitational waves as a function of frequency. And as I said, this integral is very similar to any other source that you want. It's a double integral because you want to integrate over all the time, so all the history of the universe. And you also want to integrate in this case for the particular masses, the particular lengths of the loops. If this calculation were for black holes, you would put here the masses of black holes here instead of the loops. And so since the integral is very similar, we want to do similar things. So we need some ingredients to compute this. The first one is cosmology, and I'm not going to be very original here. I'm just going to take vanilla cosmology. You can also change this in an interesting way, but if you ask me, I can tell you. But at the moment, I'm just going to take the normal cosmology. And then there are two important ingredients here. One is the number of loops at each moment in time. Also, it's a function of the length of the loop, the distribution of lengths. And the other one is the power spectrum of each individual loop, or the average, or the typical one. Okay. Now, the number density is, of course, obvious that this calculation should depend on that. What is a little bit scary is the fact that this thing has to be computed any moment in time. And of course, we cannot do simulations for the whole dynamic range of the expansion of the universe, right? So at the, if you just seen this for the first time in your life, you may say, well, how can you know the distribution of lengths of loops for all the history of the universe without having a simulation that tells you that? Well, here's where we are lucky, because a network of strings has a solution, which is an attractor solution, which is called a scaling solution, which intuitively means that if you reach this scaling solution, when you reach this scaling solution, everything scales with the horizon distance. And therefore, if you take a picture at some particular time, if you want to know how does it look later, it's just as if you just stretch the picture. Of course, that is not literally what happens. What happens is that statistically, all the properties here in the later time looks as if they were a stretch from the original one. Another important point of this scaling is that allows the network to be a constant fraction of the energy density in the background. This means already that you're not going to have a monopole problem, right? Because it's just tracking the background. But also says that it's not going to be relevant, right? You could imagine that if the strings dilute very fast, then it would be maybe important at the beginning, but not later on. But this is it's a constant fraction of the unit density of the universe. And this happens in radiation and matter, right? So in both types of evolution. So this is important. The scaling solution is very important because it allows us to do simulations. And if we are convinced that we have reached this scaling solution, then we don't have to keep going, right? We can stop there, take all the information from that network, and now extrapolate all the information for later on. And this will allow us to do the calculation of the number density at each moment in time. So the holy grail of numerical simulation of cosmic strings is to find this scaling solution. So we did this a few years ago. So these are the initial conditions for our network. The colors here mean each individual string is colored in different ways, colored by the length. So what you see here immediately is that everything looks very bluish. This is because there's one single string that goes many, many times across the box, okay? But then, of course, you also have loops, orange and yellow and green. So these are initial conditions that tell you basically that 80% of the energy is in this long string and 20% is in these other loops. So we take these initial conditions. We put it in a computer in an expanded background, and we use the Nambu-Goto equations of motion to see the evolution of these things. And the only other thing that we have to be careful about is intersections. Every time there is an intersection, we have to perform this intercommutation where we exchange partners and create loops, okay? Well, this is easier said than done. You have to do a lot of work to do this, but I can show you a movie of it. So you see that from time to time, there is a part of a string that pops up with a different color. This is basically a loop that is created from the network of long strings. The whole thing is expanding, so the long string network is diluting itself. When a loop gets created, it oscillates for a few times and self-intersects, right? Because even though I told you that the solution is easy to write, nobody says that this solution is not going to self-intersect, right? And this you can see, you know, some places you create a loop and then it breaks up into different small ones that fly off. Another thing that you can see is that from time to time, the loop appears to be oscillating and then it's removed, disappears from the simulation. Okay, this is not physics, it's not magic also. It's because we did this on purpose. We take the simulation and we look at the loops. Once we have identified that these loops are in a non-self-intersecting trajectory, basically they are going to be oscillating forever, right? Because they are periodic solutions. So what we do is we grab them, we take them out of the simulation, because having them oscillating all the time, the only thing that they do is use resources, but nothing else. It's not going to change anything. But of course, we keep them. We lock them in some place to keep them to for later use. So, So this is not the simulation that we did, because you need to run for a very, very long time before you see this scaling solution. And for that, we have to develop the code, which is a parallelizable code. It took us a while to do, but at the end, we were able to do a simulation, which is much, much bigger than the one I show you, like two orders of magnitude bigger than. So, of course, I don't show you this because if I show you this, it will be all white. So you wouldn't be able to see anything. So we were able to identify the fact that this network of string approaches the scaling. And moreover, we're able to find the distribution of sizes of loops. So we can write here the number density of loops for any moment in time and for any length. Okay. Important thing is the normalization that comes from the simulation directly. And here we also take into account the fact that the loops are, once they are produced, and they are in an all self-intersecting trajectory, they are just going to be evaporating themselves with this rule that we said before. Actually, there should be a G here. It should be gamma G mu T. Okay. All right. So we have one of the ingredients to the calculation of stochastic background. We should now look at the second one. So the second one is to compute the power emitted by a typical loop or average one, right? So if this
I have a
were,
question about the loops. Do you mind if I
yes.
ask now or should I wait?
Go ahead. Yes.
Okay. What is the typical size of a loop? You mentioned
Right.
expansion of the universe. So is it
Yeah.
light years, a megaparsec?
Right. So there are, of course, all sizes of all typical sizes, but one important ingredient that you should know is that when they are created in the network, the majority of the important loops, the ones that are going to survive a long time, are produced at a tenth of the horizon. So this is the typical size of the loop when they are created. Well, I should say those are the ones that are most likely to survive later on, okay? Which are the ones that are going to be important. And then, of course, those ones are going to be evaporating, so you can track down those throughout the history of the universe because they are going to change the size. So if you look at one particular time, well, the most abundant ones are the ones that have the size, which when you trace it back to the formation, have this length of the horizon. Okay.
So what initial conditions do you assume? You assume essentially that they're created co-moving with the universe, co-expanding?
Let's see. In terms of the loss, so the initial conditions are simple. They're, if you remember the story that I mentioned at the beginning of how, in order to find a string, you would have to find some winding of the faces of the scalar field that I mentioned at the beginning, right? So what we do is we use this so-called Bacchus-Patti-Wilenki initial conditions, which is we take a lattice, three-dimensional lattice, and we throw faces at the vertices of the lattice.
Oh, okay, that explains the structure of the initial conditions you just showed. There was a bit edgy, angular.
Right. So then we take this as the initial conditions and evolve it from there. Now, you could give velocities if you want, so they are not co-moving, as you said. But the interesting thing about the scaling, and people tried this before, is that you can change the initial conditions. You can modify these things a little bit, but the scaling solution is always going to be the same. So in some sense, the scaling tells you that you are insensitive to initial conditions. I mean, within a reason. Of course, if you change the density too dramatically, then of course you're not going to reach the same thing, or not in the same amount of time anyway.
So is your time stepping, is it covariant in the sense of GR? Because these things are large and light propagation time is important. Do you assume essentially something Newtonian or is it fully covariant? So if I choose the same initial conditions with a different slicing, I would get the same evolution.
Let's see, I'm not sure I understand the question. We evolve this network on an expanding universe.
Yeah, that's a particular choice of time that you make.
Oh
You could do different time coordinates where one part is much advanced than the other. So it's still a slice of the space-like hypersurface.
yeah, I'm not sure if this would change anything, but of course, I mean, what we do is basically solve the equations in the frame of the Freeman-Robertson-Walker universe. If you change to another frame, yeah, the network would be different.
Oh, yeah, it would look different, but the equations that you use, these are covariant equations. I mean, the underlying physics is, but in your code, do you make assumptions about that it's close to Newtonian or so? That the velocities are small? No, I guess you don't, right? You mentioned relativistic earlier. Okay, yeah, not a good question. Thank you.
It could be a good question. Maybe I'm not completely understanding, but yeah, I mean, if you think about the wall sheet, I mean, you can cut it in different ways. You can still get a loop, but the loop would be changed in shape, right?
Yes. I mean, it would
So the
look different
network,
in that sense, but the whole topology and so on would still be the same.
I think so. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. So we were discussing this, right? The second ingredient that I need is the power spectrum. So, as I was saying, if you were to compute this for, let's say, a collection of supermassive black holes merging, you would know what the power of each spiraling is, right? Because it's quite simple. So we can try to say, well, we should do the same. The only problem is that we have a lot of different shapes of loops, right? A huge variation. So the question is, what is the actual spectrum that we should put into this calculation. So the first thing that you should remember is that each loop has a number of frequencies because this is a periodic source. So what we want to compute is this P of n, P sub n, which is the power emitted in each individual normal mode, if you want, of the loop. And this calculation enters in two ways. One, in the calculation of the whole spectrum of the gravitational waves, and another one through gamma in the length of the loop, because the sum of all the power emitted in each frequency is the total power emitted by the loop, and that allows you to, and that tells you how the loop shrinks with time, right? So it enters in these two ways. So what kind of power spectrum you should expect? Well, I already mentioned particular moments or particular structures in the string that may be relevant. For example, a cusp has a power that is again g mu squared as it should, but then it drops with n like n to the minus 4/3. So it is a very slow decline. So it means that it has a lot of power frequencies as well. So if you have loops which are all dominated, or many of them have cusps or many cusps, then you would imagine that using this power spectrum is correct. Another possibility is if you have many, many kinks on the loop, then the power is different and decays a little bit faster. So the question is, what kind of power spectrum should I use? So the way to do this is, of course, to go and look at the loop. As I mentioned earlier, in the simulation, we have lots and lots of loops that once we identify that they're not self-intersecting trajectory, which are the ones that we care about, we log them, we put in the file. So now we can go and look at each one of them. I mean, there are lots and lots of them. So I pick one randomly here, and this is a movie of it. So you see several things here. The first thing is that you notice that what we do in the simulation is just discretize the loop. So the loop is made of sections which are straight, but it has a lot of them here. I don't know how many pieces are there, but they may be thousands. And they are just traveling in both directions. And the dense is such that, first of all, the solution is periodic. It repeats itself, as I promised earlier. But also it's a complicated dense, right? This is not a circular loop by any means. It's a very complicated one. And there are many more which are complicated. So you can imagine that what happens is that the tension makes some part of the loop to collapse while some of the part was expanding, and then the other way around. So this is a way to avoid each other. It doesn't self-intersect, but keeps oscillating. So the color here in the loop is the local velocity on the loop. So you also see that there is a lot of variation in the velocity, which is also important to the calculation of the power spectrum. So one thing that we could do is to take the loops from the simulation as they come out of the simulation, put it into linearized Einstein's equations, and compute the power emitted for each loop in each mode, and then average over them and compute the power. However, this is not the right thing to do, or not perfect thing to do, because we know that as the loop oscillates, it radiates. As it radiates, it changes its shape. As it changes its shape, it's going to emit in a different power spectrum. So we have to take into account this back reaction to do a good job of estimating what is the average or the typical power spectrum. So this we did a few years ago in a toy model. Instead of doing a perfect calculation, we said, okay, a smaller scale structure on the loop is going to oscillate faster, is going to radiate faster. So the loop is going to get smoother and smoother as the time passes on different scales at different times. So the toy model, what it does is it takes the loop from the simulation, it removes the structure at the smaller scales, mimicking the idea that gravitational waves are going to smooth things at the very small scales, and then looks if the loop is going to self-intersect. And this is very important, because if non-self-intersecting trajectories were very fragile, the whole calculation would be different, right? We are basically assuming that the loop, once it's in a non-self-intersecting trajectory, it oscillates for billions of times without breaking. And you can imagine if you break in two, Now you have to follow these two, but the actual power is different, right? And if it has a cascade, it's even more complicated. So what we did is, as I said, take the regional one, smooth it for a small scale, simulate it again, and smooth it again in several steps, the same again and again. So this is an example of such process. So you take the regional loop here on the corner on the top left, and you have the movie. Then you smooth it a little bit and you get the second one. Then you smooth it a little bit more. And then you finally smooth it quite a bit. The final one here is really, really smooth, right? There's a lot of structure here that is not visible there. So why do I show you this movie, apart from the fact that it's nice? I show you this movie because one thing that you can see is that even though I smooth the loop, it does not self-intersect. So this idea that self-intersections are going to happen is probably wrong. Once you get into a non-self-intersecting trajectory, modifying it by a small variations because of this process of smoothing is not going to kick you out of this type of trajectory. Okay, this is good. This means that we can proceed with the calculation. So now we can take all these steps and put it into Einstein's equations and compute the power spectrum. Okay, this is just the picture of the four. You can tell exactly what we've done, right? At the beginning, you have a lot of blobs. Here you have less, less, less. So now we did that. We took all these different steps. We put it into linearized gravity, calculate the radiation, calculate the power in each loop, calculate the power in each step of this process, and compute the final gamma. And this is a histogram of 1,000 loops from a simulation. The first thing that you notice is that this is really peaked around 50 again, okay, a little bit lower than 50. So one of the things that we needed is the total gamma, and it seems that the total gamma is pretty robust, about 50, okay? And we also computed the power spectrum, the P sub n, for these 1,000 loops, and this is the spectrum. We multiply by n to the 4/3, so you can see that at the tail of this distribution of this spectrum, you go to a constant, which means that there is some part in this part of the spectrum you are dominated by cusps, okay? So strains at the end, when they are very smooth, they seem to have cusps. So now we have both elements of the of the calculation. We have the number density and we have the power spectrum, so we can do the integral. And this is the result. The result is, again, the energy density in gravitational waves as a function of frequency. And as I promised, there is only one parameter, which is the tension, in this case, g mu. So for each value of g mu, I have the whole picture, the whole spectrum. So one thing that, there are several things in this picture that I want to point out. The first one that should be striking is the amount of range in frequency. Look at the x here. It goes from 10 to minus 10 to 10 to the 10, okay? Now, maybe you already guessed this, and the reason is easy, is because as we mentioned earlier, you produce loops at any moment in the history of the universe, right? All different sizes. And all of these different sizes of loops are emitting all gravitational waves, and all those gravitational waves are traveling towards us. So at the end, you had a collection of many different point sources that are emitting all these things towards us. Now, if you want to identify what are the loops responsible for each part of the spectrum, you can. And if you look at very high frequency, this part of the spectrum is very flat. This is understood by the calculation. And this is basically dominated by loops which are producing the radiation error, which are emitting their gravitational waves in the radiation error. And then there is this bump over here. This bump, the low frequencies, is due to loops which are created in the radiation era. They survive until the matter era, and they oscillate and emit gravitational waves in the matter era. Okay, so if you want, there are two contributions, one the radiation era, and another one is the matter era, okay? All right. The little wiggles here are due to the fact that we take into account the fact that during the expansion of the universe, the number of degrees of freedom change, and that changes a little bit the Hubble constant. So as I said, one of the most striking things is the amount of range that we have here. Clearly, the cosmic strings are, I would say, a natural source of gravitational waves in the multi-band astronomy of gravitational waves. So you have here an overlay of the different bands that that people study. At the very low frequencies, 10 to minus 9 or the nanohertz, you have pulsar timing, which is the one I'll be describing a little more now. But we also have intermediate range, the LISA range, and we also have the LIGO Virgo or the Einstein telescope. And this is very interesting because having one, you can have doubts about is this the real source or not. But if you are confident of the theoretical prediction, once you have one point, then the other ones are supposed to be fixed. Okay. Of course, for LISA we have to wait a little bit, and for Einstein telescope as well. But okay, so let's discuss pulsar timing. So as you all know, pulsars are these neutron stars that rotate really, really fast, and they emit pulses. And they are really extremely good clocks because we can measure the time of arrival of these objects with extreme precision. And this is the idea behind all the pulsar timing observatories. They monitor over the years the time of arrival of these pulses, and they model where the next arrival of a peak or a pulse is, right? This modeling is extremely hard. I mean, I don't know much about this. I only know what I can read in papers, but I can gather that it's extremely complicated modeling. it's interesting to get this right, because if you do, then you can have some handle on when the pulses are going to arrive. If there is some change in this time of arrival, this is what people call a residual time of arrival, you can attribute this to gravitational waves, because gravitational waves passing between us and the pulsar are going to create these variations of the time of arrival. The interesting thing is that these observatories work at very low frequencies, at the nanohertz. Their main target of observation was and is still nowadays the collection of the stochastic background for the collection of supermassive black holes. We know these supermassive black holes exist because we've seen in the center of galaxies. So the idea is that throughout the history of the universe, galaxies merge. As they merge, the black holes, they should find their way into binaries. And the collection of all these binaries are going to produce a stochastic gravitational wave background at these frequencies, okay? And the interesting thing is that these observatories have the sensitivity to observe the expected amplitude of these astrophysical things. But of course, we can also use it for any other source of stochastic background. And as I hope I convince you, cosmic strings are a good candidate for this. Of course, measurements or limits of the stochastic gravitational wave background have been produced by these observatories in the past. There are three major players, if you want. There's the PPTA, which is the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array, which is in Australia. And in the past, we used this to put some limit on G mu for the models of strings, of the order of 1.5, 10 to the minus 11. For the EPTA, the European one is similar, 1.1. And for the nanograph previous data, we have the order 4 times 10 to the minus 11. Now you see all these constraints are already pretty strong compared to 10 to the minus 6 value that I mentioned at the beginning. I mentioned at the beginning that for a granified theory string, you would get G mu 10 to the minus 6. 10 to the minus 11 is already quite constraining compared to that. It pushes down the tension quite a few orders of magnitude, not so much because it's eta over n Planck square, but you, I mean, these bounds already tell you that you cannot have strings with tension, with the scale of the symmetry breaking higher than 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14 GeV. So it's already important because, for example, you cannot see these strings in the CMB, okay? They are too light. So this is actually quite important. So let me now describe the nanograph data. So nanograph in this 12.5 year release, they monitor 45 pulses over the years, and they tested this, or they measured this timing residuals. So they get all these different pulses and they do the calculation of these residuals, and then they identify that there is a common spectrum red noise of some process. Okay, why do they say these very careful words? So what they have observed is that there is in the Tyman residual, the spectrum of these residuals, there is a red spectrum, which means that there is more power at small scales. And this is common. It means that it is the same one, or you can fit the same one to all the pulses. Okay, they actually describe this carefully in the paper. They say that the idea that is the fit, if you want, of a different red noise for each individual pulsar is completely disfavored. Okay, this is very important. However, they don't claim that there is an observation of a stochastic gravitational wave background. The reason is because there is something that is not there yet, which is this evidence for quadrupole spatial correlation, the so-called Helling-Downs curve, which basically tells you that if you have a gravitational wave that produces this signal, you should have correlations. I mean, for two pulses that are in the same direction, you have a very strong correlation. However, if you have one that is 90 degrees with the other one, then you should have an anti-correlation. This is basically due to the quadrupolar nature of gravitational waves, right? So they look for this this correlation, but they say there's only a weak evidence for that. Now, this is very important because without this, you can imagine that all the signal comes from some other source and is not gravitational wave, some noise or some misidentification of the center of mass of the solar system, which they do a remarkable job of doing. But so you need this quadrupole to really identify this signal like gravitational waves. They do say that there is no evidence for, or this very disfavored to be a monopole or a dipole correlation, which is also good, which means because there are many sources of noise that produce these other correlations, these other type of correlations. But in any case, even though they don't claim it, we are going to take it as a hint that there is a gravitational wave stochastic background at that level. So what they show in the paper is they show this picture, and they basically present their data by this characteristic strain of the gravitational wave with a simple power law given by the amplitude and the frequency normalized to the 1 year frequency with a spectral index. And they look at the data and, well, there are different contour plots here. This is one sigma level is this one. The two sigma level is the other one. Should only look at the orange one. The orange one corresponds to fitting of the lowest frequency of here, okay? Which is the only one that they trust is the common red noise. This one is supposed to be white noise, and they don't believe this is signal. Okay, so this is very interesting because this is not only an upper limit on the amplitude. It also tells you something about the spectral index, right? So this is a lot of more information that we had previously. But here they show this line over here, which is the spectral index that corresponds to supermassive black holes, okay? Which is in the ballpark of one sigma, definitely in the two sigma. It's still in the right neighborhood. So we're going to look at what happens if we think about this signal as coming from strings. And this has been done in some other papers by John Ellis and Marek and some other people as well. So here I'm going to concentrate on our paper that basically is going to explore how the uncertainties in the theoretical calculation change this this idea that the cosmic strings can produce this nanograph signal. So in order to do that, we have to transform our data into a way that we can compare to their reported data. This is simple to do. You just have to write what they say in terms of what we say, which is the this a spectrum of gravitational waves. So you can write what they say in terms of this omega of gravitational waves, and depends on the amplitude that they quote and the spectral index. So in the same way that you can do it that way, you can do it in the opposite direction. So for any spectra of gravitational waves that you find, you can always identify an amplitude and a spectral index at some particular region, in particular in the region of the nanohertz band. So this is what we did. Here, we plot the log of the amplitude versus the spectral index. And these lines are, so there's a 1 sigma, 1.5 sigma, and 2 sigma from the nanograph data. And we superimpose the predictions from gravitational waves from strings. Now there are 4 lines. Each of these lines corresponds to a different power spectra for individual loops, right? I told you that the highest or the largest uncertainty comes from this calculation at P of n. So here the red curve is the one that we calculate with this toy model of smoothing the loop. The blue one is assuming that everything is dominated by cusps. The green one is a bit dominated by kinks. In the mono is the one that assumes that only in the lowest mode, all the power is emitted in the lowest mode. Okay. Of course, none of these things is realistic. Okay. But our reasoning was, okay, this brackets the possibilities of things, right? You can imagine that everything is emitted at one single mode at very low frequency, or some power law, or, you know, at the tail, right? And you take 2 different power laws. So we are reasonably confident that the actual real power spectrum is going to be somewhere here. So now, in order to calculate these lines, what we do is we take different values of G mu. So for example, if you take the Bose model, which is the one from the smoothing, this is this red line. So at one end is G mu of 10 to minus, oops. At one end is 10 to minus 9, and then all the other end is 10 to minus 11. Okay, so this is the range of tensions that we explore. So clearly you see that this line cuts through the contour plots of higher probability. So you can impose, for example, what are the values of G mu to be in the 1 sigma contour. And this is what we do show here, for example, the log of G mu. So for Bose model to be in 1 sigma range, you have to be between minus 10 and minus 10.4. So we can accommodate, we can easily accommodate this data by taking the tension of the strings to be of the order 10 to minus 10 or a few times 10 to minus 11, okay? Another important point that you can see in this picture is that it's a pretty robust result, right? Because even though this power changes quite a bit, the shape changes quite a bit, the actual results are not changing that much, and the constraints that you would get are not changing that much either. So the idea that you can explain the nanograph data with cosmic strings seems to be pretty robust, even though you change or even though you take into account the uncertainty that we have on this power spectrum. All right, another idea that we explore is the idea of what happens if you have a network of superstrings. Now, what's the difference with the other case? In the case of a superstring, as I mentioned before, the string is the actual fundamental object of the string theory. And therefore, intercommutation probability is not just one, because it's a statistical process, not just a classical process, right? It's a quantum mechanical process. And therefore, the probability of intercommutation could be much lower than one, could be as low as 10 to minus 3. Now, what does this do? Well, what it does is that the network, first of all, is like moving in slow motion, right? Because every time that there's a cut, you don't produce a loop. You have to cut many strings before you produce one. So even though at the end you're going to get into this scaling regime, it takes a lot more time to get into this scaling regime. Now, that means that to do simulations, we have to do a much, much bigger volume, which we haven't done so far. So the assumption is that this process, what it does, or decreasing the intercommutation probability, it increases the density of strings, and therefore it increases the signal of gravitational waves. And one way of parameterizing is by saying that it goes inversely proportional to the probability. So here I show the same parameter space of the amplitude versus the spectral index. And so this one is the one that I did before for p equals to 1. And this is just for the Bose model, for the smoothing one. So if you take different values of 10 to minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, you see that very fast you get out of the region of 1 sigma and 2, even the 2 sigma. Okay. So this says somewhat that the data from nanograph, let's say, it does not favor the possibility of cosmic superstrings, right? Because it's harder to make it in agreement. All right. So how much am I doing in time? Because I don't have a time.
We're already like a few minutes over. 10 minutes over. Okay. So maybe I don't know how many slides you still have.
I'll make it shorter then.
Sounds good.
I'll finish. So just to make this argument again, the stochastic background that we obtain from cosmic strings covers many different frequencies, and therefore one way that we can confirm this observation, if it's real, an observation of gravitational waves, is by observing the same signal in LISA or in Einstein telescope. Unfortunately, LIGO is already outside of the range, meaning that with the actual bounds of pulsar time in array, we cannot observe this stochastic background with LIGO. But with LISA, we could, we can see actually the different power spectra. And, this is very high in the sensitivity curve compared to the value. So hopefully, if it is indeed at this level of gravitational waves in pulsar timing, LISA would definitely be able to see it. Okay, this is some slides that one of the things I just want to mention is that, of course, we have to pin down exactly this power P of n. And for that, we have to do real back reaction, gravitational back reaction. And we are actually doing this in the last couple of years. We haven't got results. I got some preliminary results, but we can see that there is a change in the power spectrum by doing this linearized back reaction. And we have to do it for all the loops. And this, of course, is extremely complicated numerically because loops are very complicated in shape. So you have different problems for different loops. Okay? And so we are still working on this. And we have to know how this affects the conclusions. So these are my conclusions. I think I hope I convince you that cosmic strings, even though they are exotic, they are in some sense a natural candidate for extensions of the standard model. We've done a lot of work in cosmological simulations, and we are getting the time of precision cosmology. So we think we have almost everything in this ingredient list under control, except this power spectrum, which hopefully will be coming soon. Now, cosmic strings are a very good candidate for nanograph data, and future observations would be able to tell us if this is correct or not. I mean, they are very exciting times because nanograph will have new data soon, but then there are the other pulsar time and array observatories which are also claiming that they see some hint of this red noise, which is extremely interesting. And of course, we can wait until, there are other ways to see if this spectrum is coming from cosmic strings or not. But at the end, some observation from LISO or Einstein telescope would definitely tell us if this is the case. Of course, an observation of stochastic background from cosmic strings would be huge for high energy physics. It would, it would be a revolution. But even if we don't, if we just keep constraining things, this is also important because it rules out many models of the early universe. And I think I should stop here. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jose Juan, for this very interesting talk and for sharing these exciting results. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I had a question. Thanks for the nice talk. So actually I had two questions. Maybe the first one is a quick one. So if I understood correctly, within the one sigma parameter space from the nanograv results, there's some parts of that region where you could sort of comfortably fit this cosmic stream model, but there's not sufficient freedom within the cosmic stream model to fit sort of, the whole one sigma contour. So there, if the result kind of got better but had the same mean value, then this would actually rule out cosmic strings.
Right. So if this contour plots would shrink and it would be over here, let's say, we would not have any wiggle room to move this thing down here.
Okay.
I mean, the point is that if you believe, of course, everything I said, the only parameters is G mu, right? So there shouldn't be four curves here. There should be only one, and it would go cross. I mean, cut across this thing, but only one. Of course, there are four because of our theoretical uncertainty. But if we reduce that, the idea would be that these lines would convert to one, and then in the future, if nanograph says, okay, the one sigma level is here, then it's not. Going to be explained without data. Of course, you would not rule out all cosmic strings, because if you decrease the tension, of course, you would not be seeing that in this experiment. You may see it in LISA, for example, or Einstein telescope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would rule out the idea that cosmic strings explain this data.
Right.
But of course, you would not rule out, and you would rule out some level of the tension, but not all of them, of course.
Right. Yeah, and if I could ask one other question. So you mentioned these scaling solutions and how that's kind of crucial to making these predictions. So I remember a couple of years ago, there was some paper kind of claiming logarithmic corrections to the scaling solutions, and then other papers were kind of refuting that. So I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
Right. These are slightly different models of cosmic strings. This logarithmic solution, logarithmic is variation of the scaling, excuse me, is for axionic strings. So axion models are basically the model that I showed at the beginning. It's just like a complex scalar field, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between those type of strings, the ones that you can get from these global strings, axionic strings, and the ones that I described today, is that this global string is coupled to a massless mode, the Goldstone mode of the field. And that means that the energy density of the string is not localized in the core, but it has a very long tail, okay? Now that long tail of energy is what is at the core, actually, of this logarithmic dependence of the scaling. Because if you imagine that you have in the course of the evolution, you have two strings, right? If you have a long tail of energy, this long tail of energy should be cut by the position of the other string, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the expansion of the universe, the strings move apart, and therefore this logarithmic tail of the energy also increases, right?
Mm-hmm.
So part of this logarithmic dependence of the scaling was due to that. Another part was claims by some people that did simulations that, in fact, their simulations show some dependence of this scaling. Now, this is controversial, and I haven't done myself the simulation, so I don't know. This, I think, is still an open problem. And it's actually important for axionic models because the abundance of axions depends on this in a crucial way. But nothing that I said today is relevant for that.
Yeah, thank you.
Because people also compute the gravitational waves from axionic strains, but I would say there's a little bit more uncertainty in this calculation.
Can I just expand on the first question that Will asked? Because I had the same question essentially. So to expand on this one sigma contour, what are the prospects for NanoGraph with the current data that they have right now and analyzing right now and be publishing in the future? Do you have a sense of how much potentially this one sigma contour could shrink?
Actually, no, I don't know much about the data. I know that they are going to release data. I don't know exactly when, but this is the 12.5. They're preparing to release the 15-year data. But I don't know more about this. Probably they don't say it to people that are not in the collaboration.
Right.
Yeah. But I mean, we are definitely looking forward to that because as you can tell by this picture, it's not completely obvious that this is going to stay there, right? There are also, I should mention, there are also these other collaborations which are also coming out with their own analysis. The EPTA and the PPTA. And in fact, I think they have an international collaboration, a pulsar time and array. And this, I think, is the best possibility because in that case, they probably would join all the, you know, single pool, all the pulsars. And the more pulses you have, probably you reduce your error bars. So I think this is something that everybody's looking forward to. And of course, these things are going to continue with SKA. SKA would also increase the sensitivity quite a bit. In the same band, basically. So we'd see many more pulses and things would get better. Not sure if it would be cosmic strings, but I think some stochastic background would be seen, hopefully.
Yeah, exciting. Any other questions? Okay, if not, well then, let's thank Jose Juan again for this wonderful talk.
Okay, thank you.